Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson is a multifaceted guitar shop offering guitar instruction, new and used guitars and amplifiers, and all accessories. Instead of experiencing the total hassle of a big box store or a snarky boutique, take the scenic drive to Fort Atkinson and experience what total customer satisfaction is all about. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic. We love guitars.
Welcome to another podcast at SlicedOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation with us. Comrade, good morning.
Hey, sir. How's it going?
As we record this on Friday morning, September 28th, explain to people what was going on in the Judiciary Committee this morning.
Well, post the extraordinary hearing with Dr. Blasey Ford and that angry guy.
Are you talking about Lindsey Graham? Oh no, you're talking about the judge.
Any angry guys? You're right. There's 11 Republicans on the committee, and so when you add Kavanaugh, it's 12 angry men.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's interesting little judicial detail there, but. It's this morning, as the hearing began, Senator Grassley, the chairman of the committee, continued what he has done throughout this process, which is an effort to rush things without having even a minimal consideration of this nomination at any level that might allow senators to provide advice and consent in a meaningful way. And so he called the hearing to order, scheduled a vote for 1:30 p.m. Eastern time, which is essentially giving roughly 4 hours for consideration. Then threw in a whole bunch of other matters
right. That
they were talking about. You know, it's like oh yeah, by the way, you know, there was something yesterday that was consequential, but we got a bunch of other stuff we're going to work on today. And, you know, it's like this very bizarre, tone-deaf opening. And then this is where it got very interesting. He was immediately confronted by a Democratic senator who, you know, suggested that they should call Mark Judge, somebody who could provide clarity. This was a witness to what Dr. Blasey Ford has alleged occurred with Brett Kavanaugh. And it was a bizarre moment because as Grassley was sort of trying to shut that down verbally, I believe John Cornyn and others literally called the vote and they started voting while Grassley was still talking. And there was a certain element of chaos. The thing, and it pegged the question of who's running the thing. It looked a little bit like John Cornyn was, taking charge. It also looked a lot, as you suggested off air a moment or so ago, like the Wisconsin legislature passing Act 10.
Well, as they had their vote whether to proceed to a vote this afternoon, mm-hmm. I don't know why they had to meet this morning to proceed to a vote this afternoon, but yeah. You know, that's. What here nor there, where literally Senator Harris from California and Senator Booker from New Jersey refused to even verbalize.
Did you see
that death stare from Kamala Harris?
Oh, I mean, well, and rightly so, Sly. This, you know, I think some people will debate whether you should sit a vote out, even sit a hearing out, because it's obviously so anti-democratic and so at odds with the basic premises of a system of checks and balances. But I'm not even sure that it was that. I think it was simply, just being aghast at the chaotic circumstance that Grassley, who seems to be willing to compromise any standard of the Senate in order to get Kavanaugh approved, was creating there. And it's going to be very interesting, obviously, to see as this day goes on and as the next few days go on, how Democratic senators, engage with this process, because it's a tough question. they are in many ways being used, the Democrats, as props in this. The Republicans attack them and accuse them of conspiring and all sorts of things like that, knowing that at the end of the day, none of this conversation is going to matter, that Grassley and McConnell are determined to go forward no matter what. That doesn't mean they'll succeed at the end of the day.
All right,
but it does mean that's how they're approaching it.
Let's go to yesterday's testimony. First of all, this is Dr. Ford.
When I got to the small gathering, people were drinking beer in a small living room, family room type area on the first floor of the house. I drank one beer. Brett and Mark were visibly drunk. Early in the evening, I went up a very narrow set of stairs leading from the living room to a second floor to use the restroom. When I got to the top of the stairs, I was pushed from behind into a bedroom across from the bathroom. I couldn't see who pushed me. Brett and Mark came into the bedroom and locked the door behind them. There was music playing in the bedroom. It was turned up louder by either Brett or Mark once we were in the room. I was pushed onto the bed, and Brett got on top of me. He began running his hands over my body and grinding into me. I yelled, hoping that someone downstairs might hear me, and I tried to get away from him, but his weight was heavy. Brett groped me and tried to take off my clothes. He had a hard time because he was very inebriated and because I was wearing a one-piece bathing suit underneath my clothing. I believed he was going to rape me. I tried to yell for help. When I did, Brett put his hand over my mouth to stop me from yelling. This is what terrified me the most and has had the most lasting impact on my life. It was hard for me to breathe, and I thought that Brett was accidentally going to kill me. Both Brett and Mark were drunkenly laughing during the attack. They seemed to be having a very good time. Mark seemed ambivalent, at times urging Brett on, and at times telling him to stop. A couple of times I made eye contact with Mark and thought he might try to help me, but he did not. During this assault, Mark came over and jumped on the bed twice while Brett was on top of me. And the last time that he did this, we toppled over and Brett was no longer on top of me. I was able to get up and run out of the room. Directly across from the bedroom was a small bathroom. I ran inside the bathroom and locked the door. I waited until I heard Brett and Mark leave the bedroom, laughing, and loudly walk down the narrow stairway, pinballing off the walls on the way down. I waited, and when I did not hear them come back up the stairs, I left the bathroom, went down the same stairwell, through the living room, and left the house.
It's hard for me to possibly imagine, as American women watched that throughout the country, and then some American men who've been sexually assaulted and never said anything, the profound impact that statement had on the country.
Yeah. Well, it was so real and so human, at the most fundamental level. I mean, it was just, and it was...
Can you speak up just a little bit, John?
I'm sorry. It was so real and so human on a fundamental level. It wasn't merely a detailing of an event. It was the way in which she read her statement, the way in which she paused. You could feel the emotion. You could feel, or at least you could sense the fear, not merely in appearing before this committee, but really even the fear of what she was describing. It was very, very powerful. And you know, it was very interesting as this went on, the prosecutor they brought in from Arizona,
Rachel Mitchell.
Yeah, just a as far as I could tell, not a particularly useful presence there. And
I didn't understand. I did,
not a particularly respected presence by the Republicans who had brought her in. They just, I think, wanted to use her as a prop to avoid having
a human shield.
But it was interesting that Rachel Mitchell tried to, as a prosecutor might, as somebody doing a witness interview might, to establish questions as regards Dr. Ford's memory of what happened. And they were saying, well, do you remember if these people were talking downstairs or what you heard, stuff like this? And it seemed like such an absurd line of questioning because, of course, this incident is something that Dr. Ford has replayed. It sounded to me like something she's replayed in her head 1,000 times, right?
At least.
Of course she remembers this. She remembers that precise incident, you know, Kavanaugh and Judge pinballing off the walls, banging against the walls as they walked out, and finally she felt that they had gone downstairs. Don't you imagine, I mean, you tell me, that if you're remembering a deeply traumatic incident in your life, that's what you would remember. You would remember those elements.
Yes, so and of course, Dr. Ford has the vocabulary to actually explain what's going on in the brain.
that was a remarkable part of the testimony that, frankly, again, I mean, this is the interesting thing. Her academic and intellectual training obviously added some insight to it, but you tell me whether you agree. I thought it also added to the sense of her as a genuinely non-political person.
Right?
Because in politics, if somebody had really prepped her on this, or, you know, like if this was anything that the Republicans were trying to suggest, they tell you not to use those clinical terms, right? Because people don't know what all these clinical terms are. But that's who she is. She's an expert on how the brain works and on some of this. And so she was using clinical terms.
And yet she didn't come off like an academic, her presentation. She had a very different, I feel like I'm making some judgment in a contest here. I'm not. But her presence was very different than Anita Hill's. Very different. She has a very different presence about her.
Well, you have to understand that because, of course, in the case of Anita Hill was a lawyer, right? Somebody who's an expert on the law, and frankly, an expert on how a lot of Washington works, or at least knew her way around it. Whereas Dr. Ford is somebody who's really been very separate from the political world. I mean, she was drawn into this, and in each case, I think Anita Hill and Dr. Ford, when they presented their testimony, it was very powerful. It was very effective, but it was different, and that's, people are different. You know, they come from different experiences. And one of the things that was striking to me is, I did think that. People were, you know, people hadn't heard from Dr. Ford at all, you know, outside of a small circle. So it, literally when she came in, this was, you know, like the intensity of everybody's attention to this was quite remarkable. When she started to speak, when she, you know, would pause, you were at once listening to her words, but also, I think, watching as this woman did something that was obviously very difficult for her and took an immense amount of courage. And then, fascinatingly enough, you literally saw as she made her presentation and as she answered questions and responded and, you know, kind of, you know, went through the first period of her testimony, you saw her realize that she could do this. Right? That you know, she knew who she was. She was more than ready to answer, to cooperate in any way. She was trying incredibly hard to make it work, right? Bending over backwards to be cooperative and engaged with the process. And you saw her recognizing that, you know, she'd come to tell her story and she could do it, that it was going to work. And it was very, I would dare to say that moving, it was something quite moving to watch, watch her testify and watch her go through this process and do it with the clarity and the power and the calm power that she brought to it.
We'll take a break. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at sliceoffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome back to sliceoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Also, Madison Teamsters, Local 695, Madison Teachers Incorporated, and Madison Firefighters, Local 311. All right, so we heard Dr. Ford's testimony. Now let's listen to Judge Kavanaugh's opening statement.
My family and my name have been totally and permanently destroyed by vicious and false additional accusations. You have replaced advice and consent with search and destroy. Since my nomination in July, there's been a frenzy on the left to come up with something, anything, to block my confirmation. People have been willing to do anything to make any physical threat against my family, to send any violent email to my wife, to make any kind of allegation against me and against my friends, to blow me up and take me down. You sowed the wind. For decades to come, I fear that the whole country will reap the whirlwind. The behavior of several of the Democratic members of this committee at my hearing a few weeks ago was an embarrassment. But at least it was just a good old-fashioned attempt at borking. Those efforts didn't work. When I did at least okay enough at the hearings that it looked like I might actually get confirmed, a new tactic was needed. Some of you were lying in wait and had it ready. A long series of false last-minute smears designed to scare me and drive me out of the process before any hearing occurred. You've tried hard. You've given it your all. No one can question your effort. But your coordinated and well-funded effort to destroy my good name and destroy my family will not drive me out. This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons.
So, I have to ask you, he says he wrote that himself. Is he sure that Stephen Miller from the White House didn't give him a little hand with that?
Yeah, Miller probably toned it down a little. yeah, he's going too far here.
On earth could he ever, in the future, not only be a Supreme Court judge, but a federal judge after that statement?
Yeah, I mean, here's the baseline concept here. He is, what you heard there was a statement by someone who runs confirmation fights, right? A hyper-partisan political operative. And that's who he is. I mean, Brett Kavanaugh ran the confirmation fights for the Bush administration. He managed, you know, battles to get controversial people confirmed. sometimes he won, sometimes he lost, but he was, you know, he was working with Karl Rove and these people to achieve political ends. Those political ends were not just about creating a more conservative judiciary, they were also about keeping the conservative base engaged and excited about taking over the courts. And that was a statement there with its references to Borking, to coordinated political hits, you know, all of this stuff. And if all that Brett Kavanaugh was what he has always been, a political operative, a partisan, you know, actor, you know, it still would have been an over-the-top statement. It would have been unprecedented in a Senate hearing, of course, but it would have just been what it was. But this is a guy seeking a position on the Supreme Court of the United States, accusing members of the Senate, and in fact, condemning the confirmation process of, by extension, the system of checks and balances, the concept of advice and consent. If he were to go on to the Supreme Court, and I would argue with you if he continues on the federal bench, it has to call into question any decision he makes regarding, you know, legislation that might be proposed and advanced by people on this committee. And
is he going to recuse himself?
Well, remember, this is the Judiciary Committee, right? So they're producing a lot of stuff that, you know, that has potential to go to the Supreme Court. And because we still have a small D democratic system, by the start of next year, that committee could be controlled by Democrats. Not saying it will be, but it could be. And so, I mean, he's essentially signaled just it sounds like a permanent hatred of these people. How do you reconcile that with the concept of a fair and impartial judiciary?
Here he is at a moment with Senator Klobuchar of Minnesota.
Most people have done some drinking in high school and college, and many people even struggle with alcoholism and binge drinking. My own dad struggled with alcoholism most of his life, and he got in trouble for it, and there were consequences. He is still in AA at age 90, and he's sober, and in his words, he was pursued by grace, and that's how he got through this. So in your case, you have said here and other places that you never drank so much that you didn't remember what happened, but yet we have heard, not under oath, but we have heard your college roommate say that you did drink frequently. These are in news reports, that you would sometimes be belligerent. Another classmate said it's not credible for you to say you didn't have memory lapses. So drinking is one thing.
I actually don't think that's the second quote's correct.
Okay, drinking is one thing, but the concern is about truthfulness. And in your written testimony, you said sometimes you had too many drinks. Was there ever a time when you drank so much that you couldn't remember what happened or part of what happened the night before?
No, I remember what happened, and I think you've probably had beers, Senator, and so...
So you're saying there's never been a case where you drank so much that you didn't remember what happened the night before or part of what happened?
You're asking about, blackout. I don't know. Have you?
Could you answer the question, Judge? That's not happened. Is that your answer?
Yeah, and I'm curious if you have.
I have no drinking problem, Judge.
Yeah, nor do I.
Okay, thank you.
That didn't seem like judicial temperament.
It was bizarre. I mean, it was painful.
He had to apologize.
Well, he did, and they took him out of the room, and they said, one presumes that someone with a leveler head, maybe Stephen Miller, I know it wasn't Stephen Miller, someone with a leveler head said to him, you know, you understand what you just did there? You know, beyond being bizarre, right, that you're in a confirmation process and you're, you know, trying to engage, as he did with several senators, in this sort of jocular back and forth about drinking and drinking games and things of that nature. Beyond that, if he had listened at all, and one presumes that when you're in, you know, literally the essential struggle of your life, as regards your political advancement. If he'd listened to what the senator said, she had described her father's struggle with alcoholism, right? I mean, and if you prepared for hearing it, remember, this is a guy who's an expert in hearings on these issues, you know, in judicial confirmation hearings. This is a guy who built his career around this, and one of the things you do is you study the senators, you find their backstories, you find, you know, who they are. You want to know a lot of information. So one presumes he does. To then do that with Senator Klobuchar, it was bizarre. It was injudicious. It was deeply troubling. And in my opinion, literally, I think that's why he did come in and you know, very quickly apologize. Because for any reasonable person, Democrat, Republican, conservative, or liberal, that ought to be red flag behavior.
Here,
this guy with such animus and such a weird disregard for the process that it's hard to imagine any reasonable person wanting to see him on a court.
Well, even before any of this stuff started, there was plenty of reason to question his integrity and judgment. Here is Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois.
Well, I'm sure that the chairman at that point will understand that is a reasonable request to finally put to rest these charges if they are false, or to prove them if they are not. You spent 2 years in the White House office that approved judicial nominees. You turned to the FBI over and over and over again for their work. Let's bring them in here and now. Turn to Don McGahn and tell him it's time to get this done. An FBI investigation is the only way to answer some of these questions.
So stop the clock. This committee is running this hearing. Not the White House, not Don McGahn, not even you as a nominee. We are here today because Dr. Ford asked for an opportunity here.
I welcome whatever the committee wants to do because I'm telling the truth.
I want to know what you want to do.
I'm telling the truth.
I want to know what you want to do, Judge.
I'm innocent of this charge.
Then you're prepared for an FBI investigation?
They don't reach conclusions. You reach the conclusion.
No,
Senator.
But they do investigate questions.
I'm innocent.
And you can't have it both ways, Judge. You can't say here at the beginning,
I wanted a hearing
moment,
look,
I welcome
thing,
any kind of investigation.
This thing was sprung on me. This thing was sprung at the last minute after being held by staff. You know.
Judge?
And I called for a hearing immediately.
Why would you resist that kind of investigation? Why would you resist that kind of investigation?
Senator, I wanted the hearing last week.
I'm asking about the FBI investigation.
The committee figures out how to ask the questions. I'll do whatever. I've been on the phone multiple times with committee counsel. I'll talk to...
Judge Kavanaugh, will you support an FBI investigation right now?
I will do whatever the committee wants to...
Personally, do you think that's the best thing for us to do? You want to answer?
You know, look, Senator, I've said I wanted a hearing, and I'd said I was welcome anything. I'm innocent.
That was a terrible, terrible moment.
When he went silent there.
He went silent.
Literally went silent.
First of all, I thought I was watching Perry Mason or Law and Order. That was incredible.
Well, I mean, Durbin, who, you know, has been in politics for a long time, hasn't been a prosecutor for a long time, I'll tell you that, was, in my opinion, the most effective.
Absolutely, without question.
Incredibly powerful. And he wouldn't let go. He literally did the right thing. He didn't go a lot of different directions. He kept it very precise. He just went to the heart of the matter, and that is the heart of this matter. Why not ask for the FBI inquiry? So he went to the heart of the matter. And then what was fascinating about it is not their interaction. I mean, that was dramatic. It was Perry Mason sort of thing. It's the kind of thing where if you're watching Perry Mason, you go, wow, that is a guilty man. But even if we don't believe, you know, no matter what you believe about Kavanaugh, whether you believe he's guilty, innocent, whatever, it was the fact that Grassley intervened in the way he did, right? He intervened very aggressively, saying, we're going to run this thing. He didn't intervene as a judge would. And remember, this is not a trial, and I accept that. But he didn't intervene as a judge would in that Perry Mason circumstance to say, you will answer the question.
Correct.
And that's where this thing fell apart. This is the crisis. This is not a trial, but it is run in a legalistic manner. The person who testifies is expected, you know, to swear under oath that they're going to tell the truth, you know, that they're going to, you know, participate in this process. They're going to try and make the system of checks and balances work so that meaningful advice and consent can be provided. And yet, Brett Kavanaugh was allowed in that circumstance to avoid and essentially refuse to answer a direct question. It was the chairman's duty at that point to come in and say, you know, he could say everything he said. You know, he'd say, all right, we're going to run this. It's not about blah, blah, blah. He's not right about that because, of course, if Kavanaugh were to ask for the inquiry, I think, especially if he'd done it in a public setting, it probably would have led to it or should have. But he's got all right. He could say all that. But at the end of it, he should have said, but a member of this committee has asked a question. This is a serious deliberative process outlined in the Constitution of the United States. Please answer the question. They didn't do that.
All right. Finally, one more clip here. This is quite a moment. At this point, Rachel Mitchell has been essentially shoved aside. And even though Senator Graham had given up his time for her, somehow he got it back. And this is what happened.
You've got nothing to apologize for. When you see Sotomayor and Kagan, tell them that Lindsey said hello. Because I voted for them. I would never do to them what you've done to this guy. This is the most unethical sham since I've been in politics. To my Republican colleagues, if you vote no, you're legitimizing the most despicable thing I have seen in my time in politics. You want this seat? I hope you never get it. I hope you're on the Supreme Court. That's exactly where you should be.
So they.
What was that?
That was theater, political theater, coming at a point where, in my opinion, Kavanaugh's over-the-top and irresponsible behavior, not only in his testimony, but in his back and forth with some of the Democratic senators, and actually his failure to make a good case for himself, created a circumstance where Lindsey Graham, who is very, very smart, recognized that if there wasn't an intervention, that it might not be possible to save Kavanaugh. And I will be very blunt with you. If Brett Kavanaugh goes on the Supreme Court of the United States, it will be because of what Lindsey Graham did in that moment you just played, and the extended, the broader intervention that he did. Obviously, I disagree. I'm not a fan of how he approached that. I think he was dishonest, frankly. I mean, there's far more consequential battles and more serious, you know, affronts to the appropriate running of the Senate than this. And the Senate has a long history of some pretty awful things that have happened and bad votes and more. But if you step back and remove your judgments on it and simply say, you know, was this a historic intervention? Yes, it was. And it's important that you play it. It's important that we discuss it because, again, I'll go back to that core point. If Kavanaugh is confirmed, if he makes it through, I think his debt to Lindsey Graham is immeasurable.
Was that persuasive, do you think, to Susan Collins?
We shall see, my friend, won't we? You know, that's we're speaking at a moment
right.
With a little lack of clarity. What we know is that Jeff Flake, a critical member of the committee who some had held out hope, might say no, object, did not.
We've seen his shtick to all too many times.
You know the cut of his jib.
We do.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying, though, is that what Graham did there was essentially the call to arms for conservatives, right? And he did it in a very, very skilled manner. The references to his own votes for
Sotomayor, yeah,
yes, exactly, was very, very powerful. He knew exactly what he's doing. And here's what I will say to you: if you followed Lindsey Graham, you know this to be a certainty. That was not off the cuff. He had prepared to intervene where necessary. It's notable that he intervened after several rounds of questioning.
Well, after Durbin had really...
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. He intervened at a critical point where it was obvious that Kavanaugh could not make the case for himself. And so Lindsey Graham decided to jettison the judicial nomination confirmation process and go for a purely political rallying cry.
The triumph, again, of a kind of reflexive partisanship. The other thing I would say is one of the things that happened in those 27 years is the Clinton story, the Clinton saga, the Clinton impeachment. And there will be a lot of monographs written in the coming years about what did one of Ken Starr's deputies really learn from the Clinton impeachment.
All right, so that was sort of John Meacham's approach to this last night. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a reminder that we have been, over the last kind of 30 years, on something of a journey as regards how the Congress is used and how it operates. And, well, I don't always agree with Meacham. In this place where you're trying to make these connections, right, you're putting these pieces together, I think that's somewhat important. Because if you listen to what Meacham is saying there about the Clinton impeachment, you remember, obviously, Kavanaugh's role at the side of Ken Starr. What we see here is why and how Kavanaugh got where he's at. He's there as a political operative. But also why and how he went to the issues that he went to in his opening statement, right? And this is an important thing that Kavanaugh did, whether you like it or not, it's not the point. But one of the important things that he did in his opening statement is go over the committee altogether, and frankly, over the Senate altogether, and give a message directly to the core conservative base. And that is, we've been at this for a long time, brothers and sisters. We've been fighting for a long time. I'm here now. And all of the stuff we've been talking about, all the fights we've been in, have come down to this.
It was the bloody shirt moment.
Right, it was. It was Borking, right? He's talking about Borking. Mm-hmm. He's talking about Clinton. And then he's bringing it right up, very important to remember, right up to Trump's election, right? Anger at Trump's election. And so he's essentially doing, I would argue, what Rush Limbaugh would do or what a Fox News personality might do in such a circumstance, carefully running through all of the complaints, all of the objections, all of the passions over the years, and saying it comes down to now. Don't believe what your own ears are telling you. Don't follow your heart here. Don't get soft on me. It's a long, long struggle. Follow me through. You know, help me make your calls. Act on my.
Well, I got to wrap it up, but I will say this: if that's the reaction, and they push him through with that approach, then there'll be a reaction to that action. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, five more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.